This session is a continuation of the interview with Ralph Wagner Woolard, a highly decorated veteran of the European Theater of World War II. The first interview took place on July 19, 2007. Today is July 30, 2007, and we are in the WILL television studio in Campbell Hall at the University of Illinois in Urbana, Illinois. My name is Harriet Williamson. I am a producer with WILL Radio. Also in the studio is Mr. Woolard's wife, Wilma Lee Broughton Woolard, and Julius Bolton, who's director of lighting, sound, and camera. In the last two sessions on July 19th, Mr. Woolard told us about his background, how he became a soldier in the U.S. Army, his training, his transport to Africa, and descriptions of several major battles, for example, Monte Cassino and Anzio. At the end of the last session, Mr. Woolard had taken us through Rome to the town of Magliano, where he was in another battle and subsequently suffered multi-wounds, followed by surgery in Naples with a four-week recovery period and sent to a reconditioning camp. Does this take us through July 1944? Am I correct in the date, or do I have that?
June 14th was the date of the injury, okay. And then I joined the my outfit in August, toward the end of August.
Okay. Mr. Woolard, could you please identify your rank in Army Company and Unit and continue your story?
Yes. My rank at the end of the war and for a couple of months before the end was Staff Sergeant. I eventually became a squad leader of the intelligence squad. Prior to that, all through the Italian campaign, I had the rank of corporal, which is really an assistant to the squad leader. Mm-hmm. And I was in Naples at a hospital, which was really a tent hospital, and had, I thought, very good care from nurses, doctors, the entire staff, and a friend of mine who had been wounded at the same time I was wounded, his name was Waylon P. Dawes, he lives in, he was one of the original members of the 36th Division, a very slightly built fellow with some college behind him and a tremendous sense of humor, but he liked Beano pretty well. He was wounded in the knee, and he was sent back to his outfit, to our outfit, before I was. But in a march that they had to make, his knee got to swelling again, and it was about the size of a large grapefruit. And the unit sent him back to the hospital. There were several hospitals in the general area where I was located, and he was to go to another hospital, but everyone had to funnel themselves through an admissions officer and then off to whatever hospital they were to get the best treatment in. Dawes failed to go to the admissions unit. He had been drinking a bit of vino, and he was a happy-go-lucky fellow. His intent was to look me up, and which he did. He found me, and I was not supposed to get out of bed by doctor's orders. But I knew that Dawes should be over at the admission office. I said, "Dawes, come with me. We'll go over." I got some crutches and took him over there. He was happy all the way, and we met the admissions officer. The admissions officer said, "Roll up your pant leg." He did so. Of course, it was a huge knee. And the admission officer says, "Soldier, just what is it you can't do with that knee?" Dawes looked at him for some time, and he said, "Sir, I can't play the piano with it." It didn't set very well with the admissions officer, but nevertheless, Dawes got in, and he had an injury that never allowed him to come back to the 36th Infantry Division, which I was in all through the war. At the toward the end of August, they said that I should go to a reconditioning camp, which was 10 or 15 miles north of Naples. It was a small village just on the coastline of the Mediterranean. We took daily swims in the Mediterranean. We walked or hiked around a mountain and did some running for almost a week. The interesting thing about that location was that it was called Lake Averno. It was an old the mountain itself was a volcano at one time, but had been filled in with water. Mm-hmm. Beautiful place. It in the Virgil's Iliad, it was the entrance to hell, and the as the story goes. And sometime I'd like to go back, but haven't made so yet. At the end of that period, the reconditioning camp, I was to rejoin my outfit. Now, the 36th Division had been pulled off the Italian front and was now in France. They had led the invasion to southern France and up the Rhone Valley, and I was to join them in southern France. The division had, or in wherever they were when I could catch up with them, the division had a rather easy time of it, comparatively speaking, in going into southern France. It was nothing like Normandy and northern France. But there were men who were lost. I think the most serious wound that anyone in my squad had was a little finger, which was cut and was crooked for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. But the fighting at the once a bridgehead had been developed, a beachhead had been developed, then the Germans retreated very rapidly. They knew that they couldn't fight on so many fronts. They had to pull their lines together. Matters of supply were critical. And so the German troops vacated much of southern France up through the Rhone Valley, and we in pursuit of them. Every once in a while, they would stop and fight a delaying action. And it took a couple of weeks for us to get up to a point where they really were determined to make a stand. In that time, we had a few days off, maybe from the line. They'd pull us out for a couple of days and then we'd go back in. It was not, at that particular time, it was not quite as intense as the fighting in Italy. But there are some scenarios that might be of interest here. Every once in a while, you see some things that you won't see in any place other than in actual warfare. For instance, we attacked one village, French village, and the Germans were moved out, and I was rummaging around in a house What I was really trying to find was some chicory. Now, I knew that the French were using chicory rather than coffee. They couldn't get it. And we were out of coffee, and I was trying to find in this house some chicory, which I didn't find. But all of a sudden, I heard a lot of commotion. I looked out the window, and here were a group of Frenchmen. I'm assuming that they were members of the French Forces of the Interior, which was a small group of French patriots who occasionally were act to disrupt German movements. They'd sabotage a train or shoot up some Germans, which they thought they could. But looking across the street, this was into a kind of a municipal building, and there was a public square. There were 18 or 19 Frenchmen and one girl. She was a woman of about 20 years, I should say. And I called one of the squad members who spoke French, and I said, "What are they doing over here?" And they're yelling, and he said, "Well, they're accusing her of fraternizing with the Germans. She had a German boyfriend." And they took out some scissors and some shears, and they cut off all of her hair, and then told her that she was to leave the community. That pointed in the direction. Mm-hmm. And they got down to the bare skin and in her hair. This was not the same every place. It was duplicated in a lot of different towns, and sometimes it was more, they would strip the woman of all of her clothing, shave her hair, and send them out of town.
So that was the first time you had seen that?
That was in northeastern France, mm-hmm. and that was... It bothered me, frankly. Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, that you fellows probably never did too much to oppose the Germans. In my estimation, they occasionally would get something done, but here they were picking on this woman. But there are things like that you can't control. Well, that was out of our jurisdiction, and we had to move on. At another point, I think I might have told you there were two fellows in my squad who could speak German. One was a young man from Chicago whose parents had been killed in a German concentration camp. He was gotten out of Europe, out of Germany, by an uncle who lived in Chicago, who was able to manage some way of getting him back, or getting him to Chicago at the age of 14. Mm-hmm. he was a very bright fellow, a Jewish fellow. And he had an intense feeling about the Germans. And you can understand it. We, of course, part of our job was working with prisoners, taking prisoner when we could, interrogating them. And, of course, this young man had to take a good active part in that. You know, with such questions as what division are you in, would pose this to the soldiers. What kind of armaments do you have directly facing this sector? How about tanks? We hear tank movement at night. We know there are tanks there. How many do you have? Well, some Germans would talk and some wouldn't. And you had to ascertain them from those who would talk whether they were telling you the truth. And but I recall one incident very well. This is in northern France again. It was we had an officer, a German officer. He was rather smartly dressed. His clothing was in good shape, but he was arrogant as the dickens. And he told us in no uncertain term that we would never beat Germany, that this was, you may advance a bit, but you'll have to go through the Siegfried Line, and there's no way you can get through it. My interpreter, young man, took exception to this fellow's demeanor, and he looked him up and down, and he noticed a ring on his finger. He said, give me that ring. The officer said, no, he would not. Again, the command was repeated, give me that ring. And he said he would not. It was an heirloom from the family. It was his, and he was going to keep it. He had that right. Now, I was in charge of the squad at that time, and I wasn't going to let anything happen that shouldn't happen. But I could see that this young man was demanding the ring, that he was extremely angry, and he made a move to take his bayonet out. And he said, now give me the ring. Well, the officer took it off and threw it in the ground. And it was repeated, give me the ring. You stoop over and get it. Which he did. He handed it to the interpreter. And he took it and threw it as far as he could throw it. He didn't want the ring. He just wanted to put this soldier, this officer who was so arrogant, in his place. And those things happen. The same, not far away from here, and within a couple of days of that event, we were in another battle, this time with SS troops. Perhaps you've heard of the expression. The SS troops were the elite of the German army. They were their feeling for Hitler. He was almost a god for them. But we had defeated them in this battle, and there were always some wounded that they have to be taken care of, both German and our own. And there was an SS trooper on the ground, and our aid man was giving him transfusion or a blood supply. This young man I was telling you about, our interpreter, who is Jewish, as I said, leaned over to this SS trooper and says, that's Jewish blood you're getting. The SS trooper said, Nichts haben. He tried to pull this out of his arm. Fortunately, the aid man and another fellow were there to stop him. But those are the kind of things that happen. Of course, there are moments when things are a little lighter. We in that same area in France. Mickey Rooney, the actor and comedian, came in and gave him, we were back off the line for a day or two, and he gave a program. He was quite humorous, funny. And then, for some reason, we were, my squad was eating. We had some canned rations, and Rooney pulled over. He was had a Jeep that somebody had a driver, of course. But he saw us eating, he pulled over, and he said, "I'm hungry." And so he ate with our squad. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, was on stage most of the time. He was quite a jokester. And after eating, he moved on. And but it was a lighter moment that you are.
Did that help, do you think, with the morale?
Did it help?
Mm-hmm. Or not?
Yes, I think it did. There were others, of course, who entertained. But it was a diversion, mm-hmm. and you appreciated any diversion. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there were some visitors that we'd, and this seems strange, but the Red Cross girls. They were active, and they would come to your unit and banter with you a little bit. And of course, this was out of artillery range. I never cared to see them come because they always brought donuts. And if you got donuts, you know you were going right back up on the line. So I much preferred not to see them. And they were, I think, much better help and aid to what we called rear echelon troops, troops who were in the back. As we moved up closer to Germany, we approached this area that is known as, the Ardennes Forest, the Vosges area. The Ardennes Forest is a beautiful stretch of huge trees, and we ran into also the wine country very close to it. We were in another battle, and it was a very right within the wine area of France, and there were several little villages that were important in the wine industry. But I recall one of them, and we again had been in a battle for this little town, and there was still some fighting going on, but the fighting at that point was between tanks. There was a tank battle. And we were in a house and kind of trying to protect ourselves from any stray artillery shells. And there was a woman in there in the house. She was, we found out, very close to 90 years of age. I think she was 88. And she could speak French and German both. As most people in the wine country could. She said that this was the third war that she had seen from this house. She had lived in this house all of her life. the Franco-Prussian War of 1872, World War I, 1914 to 18. And here she was in the 1940s witnessing the Third War. And she had escaped injury on all of them.
So he must have felt a special need to protect her.
Yes. Well, she, we had a young man in our squad who was had movie star qualities. He was a good-looking young fellow. And he had been in a rifle company originally and had done some rather heroic things. And he could also speak French, and he was transferred to our intelligence unit. So this old woman took a shine to him, and she had quite a sense of humor, and she said she offered to marry him if he would take her to the United States and they could start life all over again. She was a very amusing woman with a good spirit.
Do you think she survived the war?
I suspect she did. Mm-hmm. Because it very quickly moved on from there. And I'm sure she had probably relatives somewhere. We were in the wine country, and we were rather certain that we were going to have a big battle for a town called Sallustadt. And it's right in the middle of a wine country, and the question was, what kind of armaments were down in that town, and how are we going to find out what they are? We could do flyovers and so on, but we knew that this was a big rail center, and that supplies for all the German troops in a broad area in there were brought into town by train. We knew that from aerial observation. So my squad got the, I say, honor. It was more of a real challenge to go to infiltrate the line and determine what was going on in Sallustadt. Sallustadt was close to 15 miles from where our general line was. And between where we were and Sallustadt, it was heavily forested, either heavily forested or vineyards. And the best chance of going undetected was through the forest. So we took a reinforced squad. We had a couple of three fellows from one of the other squads in the headquarters company. And then a sergeant from the Pioneer section. So the challenge was to get through the mountains, to get to a point where we could observe what was going on in town. And we started one night and through the forest, and we got through the German line, the front line, okay. We were marching at night, We saw only one person. This was a Frenchman. This was about 11 o'clock at night. And I don't know what he was doing out of his house, but we talked to him and asked him if he had seen any German soldiers in the area. He had not, he said. We weren't quite certain about him because there were some divided loyalties in that area of Alsace-Lorraine. Some people had German sympathies, most of them were French, were sympathetic to the French. But you never knew. The question was, what are we going to do with this foe, you know? And some wanted to do away with him, some wanted to take him with us. In the end, we talked to him and told him that we're going to let him go. But if things didn't work out as we wanted, we would be back, you know. So we got 12 miles, at the best estimate, behind the German lines. And we found a hotel and restaurant, beautiful place, up on this mountainside. And when morning came, we could look down in the valley and see the city of Sillistadt. Now, it's a city probably of 20,000 people, something like that. We also had an artillery observer with us. I didn't mention this. He's a fellow who is, really belongs to the artillery division, but he's a forward observer, and he would often be with my squad because we would try to occupy a place where we could see a lot. And he could call for artillery fire from our positions. So he was with us. And with the coming of light, we saw no Germans, and that is in our immediate area. We had the artillery observer look down into the city, and he said, I think we're too far away from our own artillery, but I'm going to try to lob some shells into the city.
Oh, my goodness.
And he did that, but they would fall about half mile short or a mile short, and so that was useless. But what we did observe was the trains coming into town, and with all kinds of armaments and ammunition, food, etc., and reinforcing the troops in this town and in the general area. Now, we remained up there another night, and as night fell, about 8 o'clock in the evening, we, as yet, no one knew we were there, except our own troops. We heard a car. We thought it was a car, and it was coming up a road to this small hotel. And we knew that this would be German, very likely. And so we surrounded the parking area in some bushes and just waited. And this car came roaring up, and two officers got out. One of them was a Lutheran minister who was a part of the German army. You know, there's some misunderstanding about the role of the Lutheran Church in the war in Germany. Some of the Lutheran ministers would not put up with Hitler at all and were killed. or escaped. Some decided that they would go along and try to help where they could. So the other officer was a regular infantry officer, but they came up to this hotel thinking that they could get something to eat, to eat and drink, not knowing that we were up there. Mm-hmm. Well, I failed to mention that the owners of the hotel were there when we got there, and they we had them locked up in a room. So we had to interrogate those prisoners, and we put them in the hotel and locked them in a room and put a guard over it. And then by the next day, our division had gathered enough steam that it had moved forward 12, 13 miles, and we rejoined them.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you rejoined them, did they come up to this hotel?
Yes, they did.
And had they encountered any fighting on their way up?
Originally, they did, and but as the Germans quickly realized it was a formidable force, mm-hmm. and they knew that in order to fight it, that they would have to get back to Celestat, mm-hmm. because there the they had fortifications, and they could do house-to-house fighting. It was once our troops got in position close to Celestat, and then went into the city, it was a terrible battle. It was a frightful battle. And then we pushed the Germans out of town, but the next day they counterattacked, and again, a very heavily fought battle. And but eventually we won and pushed the Germans on out. We received a compliment from the German general who was commander of the troops there. He said at the end of the first battle, he turned to his troops, or said to his troops, "We're going back in, and we want you to fight as well as members of this 36th Division fought." Mm-hmm. So they respected our division.
What made it so frightful? Was it because it was hand-to-hand, or house-to-house?
It was both. It was both. It was just house-to-house. Mm-hmm. House-to-house. And we had tanks, and they had anti-tank guns. Probably the best weapon in the war was their German 88-millimeter anti-tank gun. It was a tremendous weapon.
What was it that made it such a great weapon?
It was muzzle velocity, where the shell moves through the barrel and comes out at such a high speed that you could shoot flat trajectory for a long period. That is, without dropping to the ground, it just would keep going. Mm-hmm. And it also had high penetrating power. It was so pitiful in North and North Africa. We had tanks that were 57 millimeter, which they would not penetrate the German tank even. Mm-hmm. And but this was a very, very fine weapon.
Were there civilians also still living in this town?
There were a few, but not many. Mm-hmm. Most of them would scatter out. I recall we took a prisoner in Salastat at one of the, I've forgotten whether it was first or second battle, but he was a young man about our age. And we'd been fighting all day, just house to house. And he was just sick of the war. He was tired, and we were tired. And I had one of our German-speaking interpreters say, tell him, we're tired, we're in this house, we're going to sleep for a little while. Now, you're going to get over in that corner, and you turn your back to the rest of us, and if you make one move to get up or move around, it'd be your last. You know, just put in the strongest terms we could. He says, don't worry about me. He said, I'm sick of it. And he lay down and went to sleep. That was one of those moments. But it was a terrific battle. We were in the wine country. If you ever have a chance to go, you should go. It's just beautiful. We were in a little town called Ribeauvillet. Today, if you go there, you'll, it's a very expensive town to visit. But Ribeauvillet was perhaps 10,000 people. And I was, by this time, head of the squad. But company commander wanted us to go out at night on a point that would be close to German lines. He wasn't quite sure where the German lines were, neither were we, but we went out about 10 o'clock at night to through some vineyards and to a point where we thought would maybe be a good observation point. And we dug some holes. We had a new man with us, and he was an extremely nervous fellow, and I did what my sergeant did for me when I first joined the company. I said, you come and get in with me. So we had a hole we dug together, and but all this time we were listening. And we knew that we were within 40 or 50 feet of German troops. I knew enough German by this time that even I could tell it. And they were talking, and eventually they heard us there. But the young man I was with would... he wanted to smoke. And I said, you're not to smoke. You would give your position away. You can't light a cigarette without a flare of some sort. Well, I had to get up out of the hole. One of the men wanted something. And we were trying to decide what our next steps would be. But when I got back to the hole with this young fellow, he was smoking. And I said, you know, I've told you, you're making a target out of yourself and all the rest of us. So I said, I'm going to have my own hole, And you may have dug your last. Well, I started to walk away to find a different place to dig in. And at that time, a shell landed. And I got my second wound that evening. It was a wound to the chest and bicep on the left arm. The only thing to do, I had to walk back to the company. Well, the company headquarters was in town, and go to an aid station, which was close, close to the headquarters company. So I got in town and found the aid station, got some temporary patching up, and they put me in a house with a room or two in it. And there were a couple of other wounded fellows in there. And then the Germans were quite active in that area, and they'd sent troops in on a patrol, came into town, and were shooting. You know it's German troops because of the sound of the weapon. And they sounded like they were going to come down the street where I was. Mm-hmm. And I know I sat up all night with my own weapon, just thinking that they might come in. But then the next morning, I was sent back. Now, this was on December 17th. And the Battle of the Bulge was going on up in northwestern France. And we knew that it was going on. And we heard radio reports occasionally on it. But I was sent back to a chateau, beautiful French chateau, for treatment. And this was the night before Christmas. We had some entertainment at this chateau. Catherine Cornell, a great actress, and a British gentleman, I since have forgotten his name, but they put on the play, The Barretts of Wimpole Street, which was, the chateau had its own theater, stage, lovely place. And then some of the actors came around and talked to the wounded. The next day, I was sent to southern France for further treatment there. This was near Nice, a lovely, lovely area. We were put into an old TB sanatorium. It was a very nice place. Mm-hmm. Got very good care there. And I was there. I was trying to recall just when I did, at the end of, it was toward the end of January that I got back to with my troops again.
So you had about a month break?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now what happened to, did you catch up then with the men who you were with when you were wounded?
Yes,
and
I
was
did.
The person who was in that foxhole who
I never saw
smoked?
Him again. I don't know what happened to him. He hadn't been with us very long. And I found that my squad, and all through the war, it changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. There was no one in it at the end who was in it at the beginning. Mm. Either wounds or killed. Our intelligence officer was killed, the first one in Italy, the second one, a Captain Knox, a very fine man, killed by sniper fire. He stepped out in front of a tank, and a sniper got him.
How many men would be average in your squad?
Well, ideally we were 12, but usually there were 6, 7, and 8, mm-hmm. right in there.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, the attrition was such that you always had a few who were had been with you a few mm-hmm. months. And they were a very interesting group of men, I must say. All of them were good, intelligent fellows, but some most unlikely to be in the Army. There was one of them who was 39 years old, and he's blind in one eye.
Hmm. And that was not a war wound?
No. Hmm. No, he was blind when they took him in. And he could never understand how he got it. He had to lean way over to sight his rifle. And but they were needing men, and that's what happens, I'm afraid.
Now, you were very young. You were 20 years old.
Yes, I was.
Okay, and you were leading the squad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Toward the end of the war, and one of the Jewish boys was probably 30, and he died just recently. I used to go visit him in Florida. One fellow was 39, a couple were 25, so on. Neuberger, the boy whose folks were killed in the concentration camp, he was 20 also.
Mm-hmm.
And he was... they were fine soldiers. At the end of the war, we still had to act as soldiers, but they didn't like being a soldier then, at that time. They were became a little bit difficult to work with, and first sergeant had to reprimand a couple of them for their behavior. But they were good soldiers at the time. They needed to be soldiers. So, after Ribeauvillé, we moved rather quickly on into Germany, and In moving into Germany, we found some things that were most unpleasant. Well, first of all, to get into Germany, we had to go through the Siegfried Line. And the Siegfried Line had been compared with what was the French Maginot Line, which they felt was impenetrable. But the Germans felt that their Siegfried Line was really a steel ring and no one could go through. Well, it really consisted of all kinds of tank traps, which were huge concrete pieces that tanks could not get over. And then they had bunkers. These bunkers were built into the sides of the hills and camouflage. The walls were 3 feet thick. And there was vegetation on top of them. Mm-hmm. They had slits in the concrete so that the Germans could fire out through those slits. And then in the forested areas, they had cut all the trees down in front of these bunkers, cut them down so that anyone approaching the bunker would be seen. And they had those in a ring, a very tight ring around the German border.
How many miles did the Siegfried line, how long was that?
How long was it?
Mm-hmm. You're changing tape? Okay.